cavalry, and fought off Union soldiers when they started attacking the drovers and the trail herds. Okay, Brother John, we're talking about legendary cattlemen now.
Let me tell one.
Okay, Vic wants to tell one.
Back in the 1880s, when Likes Brothers was going into the cattle business, they were shipping cattle to Cuba and whatnot, and they maybe I've got it wrong. Maybe it wasn't Likes. Maybe it was John Leslie. But he was a kind of a banker and whatnot, not much of a cowboy and cowman. But he went in partners with a man by the name of Tolles from up here in Taylor County. And they bought cattle all up in here and drove them to Tampa and shipped them to Cuba and whatnot. Well, the Tolles, his Martin Tolles was his son. And I knew him when I first come to Florida and got to work with him a little bit, not a whole lot, but he was quite a cowman for his day. And yesterday, his granddaughter was here. So that would be the great-great-granddaughter of a man that went in business in 1880 in the cow business.
Good deal, Vic. When we say he's going to tell one, these are not big jokes or anything. These things actually happen. And now that you mentioned it, I want to tell something about Bone Mazel, the Florida cracker, probably the most famous of all Florida cowboys, born in 1863 and died in 1921. When Vic mentioned the Likes brothers, Bone couldn't read and couldn't write. And the only thing he could write was his name. And he was driving a bunch of Likes cattle to Tampa from down in DeSoto County. And his old horse, they were going to ship them by steamer to Key West and Havana. Well, Bone's old horse just about gave out on him just south of Tampa. And he looked across over in the fields over there, and there's a black man plowing with a plow horse. And Bone told some of his friends, just keep herd moving. I'm going to go over there and trade horses with him. And one of the men told him, says, well, Bone says, you'd have to pay boot because that plow horse looks better than your cow horse. And Bone says, well, I'm going to try anyway. So he rode over there, and one stayed lagged along behind just a little bit to watch. Bone said it, and he said that Bone talked to the black man a little while and took out a pencil and a piece of paper and started scribbling on it, you know, and he knew Bone couldn't write. So in a few minutes, they exchanged horses, and Bone came riding back on the plow horse, and a fellow asked him, says, Bone says, what were you doing over there? He said, I saw you scribbling on a piece of paper, and says, everybody knows you can't read or write either one. He said, well, hell, he couldn't either. Let's get a little bit of information about some of the legendary Seminole ranchers. After all, they were ranching here when some of these settlers came in from Georgia and the Carolinas.
Thank you.
Didn't I introduce you?
No, not this trip.
Not this time.
Okay. Sanlo Johns from Brighton Indian Reservation.
Thank you. I'm glad we got that out of the way. Let's try to figure out whether you introduced me or not. I told these gentlemen this morning, I hadn't been here as long as they have. They know all the history. I don't. Mine was told to. I just got here not too long ago, and they're talking about 1800s and 1900s and 1920s and 1930s. Well, I wasn't quite here yet, I don't believe. And of course, I'm not going to tell my age. I was telling Fay a little earlier that I remember Vic. It's been a while ago. I said, first time I ever met him, I knew he came from Texas because I introduced him. And a friend of mine and I were riding bucking horses back then, and he told me, he said, feller, he said, don't you fall off of that horse, and scared the heck out of me, because, you know, I was already scared to start with, and I didn't know whether I was going to ride or not. It's one of those things that you sure you're going to ride him, but then somebody comes up and tells you something like that, you know, you kind of lose your concentration and everything. And I said, oh my God, here I go. But anyway, that's been about 20 years ago or less. And but anyway, that's the first time I ever met Vic, and from then on I've known him to be a gentleman, and he's always treated people, I'm sure, that like the way I treat them, like I like to be treated. So we appreciate him being on the panel with us, or I appreciate being on it with him, because he's the one that asked me time or two, and he said, why don't you get on it with us, tell us a little bit about the history of the Seminoles and see of the type of cattle that we raise and everything. So, and it just so happened this thing fit in just right, because the chief asked me if we'd come over here and show our videotape of our cattle sale, which we're involved in for the past 3 years, and this is the way we've been getting rid of our cattle. Instead of putting them on a steamship and driving them to the steamships, we just put them in a corral, and after we sell them, we just put them in a corral, and these people that buys them brings their trucks, and we just load them out and ship them to wherever they want to take them to, which makes it a whole lot nicer than these guys had it way back, because I'm sure I've known Junior all my life, and it's not too easy day working, because I've day worked with him time or two here and there years ago, and in fact the same places I probably was coming right behind him, and he was probably on a faster horse and just stayed ahead of me the whole 2 or 3 years that he made the circles that I made, the same circles that he made around Fort Pierce and different areas that he works. So we, you know, it's something that you don't study to in books or anything. It's something that you want to do, and you have to learn it the hard way. They always say these cowboys are hard-headed. I believe they are, because you can't tell them nothing. They find out themselves that whatever everybody tells them is the truth, but they love that type of work. I remember at times when a feller would say, well, I'm going to go over here and mammy up these calves. And I used to think, now, what in the world is he talking about, mammy up these calves? He's talking about four or five different people owning cattle in one herd that before you pin them, he rides through them, he checks them all, and he said, okay, go ahead and pin them. I know whose calves these are. And then I used to wonder, I said, now, where in the hell did he learn that? I need to know a little bit about what he's doing. So I watched a lot and didn't ask a whole lot of questions, because back then if you asked too many questions, people knew you was dumb right away. But as long as you kept quiet, well, you got along real good. And every now and then when you ride up to somebody, you'd ask them, hey, which way is the gate? Which gate are we going to go through? You didn't say that too loud because you didn't want everybody to hear that. Anyway, most guys, you know, they point a certain direction and everybody rides that way. You don't go around ahead of them and come back. You just ride behind them if you want to stay with the crowd. So, but this is one of the things that I found out that there was I didn't know that people done things like this. As I mentioned earlier, we've had cattle that we'd pin up at night, keep anybody from, or keep the animals in different, or keep the cattle from straying off, because we didn't have no cross fences back then. And so I used to wonder, well, why this, why that? But I wouldn't ask why. And every now and then I'd ask, but the amazing part to me was when someone say, well, let me mammy these cattle up before we pin them, and then we'll go ahead and pin them. So you give them about 15, 20 minutes, depending on how many cattle or how many calves was in this herd. You'd give a guy 15, 20 minutes. He'd ride through them. He said, okay, boys. Throw his hand up and just wouldn't say nothing. He'd just motion to you. So you had to have pretty good eyes. You know, you had to be like a dog. You had to smell and could see. Because if you couldn't smell a cow, well, then you just wasn't too good a cowboy. And you had to see your foreman or whoever was ramrodding, because if he just made a circle and point whatever direction you're going to go to, that's where you went. But anyway, that's what got me interested, is when this guy said, well, let me mam him up. And 9 times out of 10, we'd get these cattle in there, and everyone that comes through, well, he said, well, it belongs to Junior. This here belongs to Vic. This here belongs to Stan. This belongs to this. And I used to wonder, I said, man, you know, he can't be that daggum smart. But it don't take long. If you know what you're doing, it don't take long. You learn that pretty quick. But you don't learn it overnight either, because I know I used to try it, and I was telling somebody here a while ago that I know Dr. Warnick for years and years at the university, and we used to test cattle, and I'd always tell him, I said, Doc, I know this cow, she's bred, she's going to have a calf. And he'd look at her and said, now, how do you know that? And I said, well, I know she is. He said, let's test her. He'd test her and said, yeah, you're right. So we'd go on like this here at the university. We'd just kind of steady under him, and then he'd come out to our place, and we'd do the same thing. He said, Stello, he said, you got to where you can tell him, can you? I said, no, sir, I've just been fooling you all this time. But we enjoy doing things like that, and he's not the only one. If it weren't for folks like him and Dr. Crockett, and Dr. Kroger, it'd be pretty rough for us today, because we got those guys to sort of analyze the type of venture this morning that that it wasn't, if it wasn't for the mineral here in South Florida, I mean, we don't have any, and if we didn't get any to be put out and experimented on different areas, our cattle probably wouldn't weigh over 600 pounds a day. But now we got these guys here to steady this thing for us, and we have our own mix that does good for us in our area because of these guys that had run some tests for us and say, you boys need this type of mineral. And, of course, at times we may not be able to afford it, but we have to have it to keep our cattle in strong bone and healthy cattle, because this is this day and time you got to have everything you can for cattle. In fact, you got to keep your cattle healthier and your wife, I think, at times, because if you don't, your wife will get down, your cow will too, and then you got two doctor bills. But anyway, my wife's here, so I better not say too much about her.
Thank you so much. A couple of the people that he mentioned there, Dr. Joe Crockett and Dr. Melvin Coger. Dr. Coger came to Florida in 1953 from New Mexico A&M. It's New Mexico State University now. And he brought with him six of his top students at New Mexico A&M, and they fanned out here in Florida. Joe Crockett is one of them. Dr. Coger, we might go ahead and say that he is truly a legendary cowman in Florida, because he's probably the top geneticist in the world today, wouldn't you think? And the Seminole tribe has benefited from his expertise and these other fellows that came in here with a fabulous program for the University of Florida. Vic, did you?
No, but I wanted to say something about, I can't explain all these things, and lots of these cowboys can't either. And what Santo was telling you a minute ago about him looking at cows and could tell whether they're bred or open, I can do that, and all old cowmen can do it. And how we do it, there's no way that I can explain how we can look at them and do that. There's two or three things that you can catch on them, but I can't explain it, and I don't think Santo can either.
No, sir, I can't explain it. It's pretty hard. You can you look for some things that you're used to looking at, and I guess, you know, it's like your billfold. You know, if you got a couple bucks in there, you know you got it. You don't have to look at it every minute to see that you got it. You know you got it. But if you go to a store and get back and you spent some money, then you go to wonder, did I spend those $2 or if I still got it? So, it's something in that similar, because, I mean, I can't put a finger on it and say, well, it's because she looks like this. It's pretty hard to say. I always told Dr. Warnock, I see the twinkle in her eye because I see she's well satisfied.
The university put on a school down in Manatee County one time, showing all them young fellas how to pregnancy test cattle, tell whether they're bred or not, you know. And I was sitting up on the fence behind the chute, and they asked me if I was going to do that. And I said, no, I said, I don't need to. And every cow that'd come in, well, I would say whether the cow was pregnant or not. And I forget the university man that was testing them and making sure that everything was right. And I'd come along, and one would come in, I'd say, well, that one's bred. And he'd test him, and that's the way it'd be. And I'd say, that one's open. And pretty soon, I kept saying that, and here he had all these people there. He was trying to learn them something. And he looked up at me, and he said, how in the goddamn hell can you tell? We're not supposed to tell all that, but I had to tell that.
Well, I asked. They were referring a while ago to the mammy of the calves. I may not be the toughest hand at it, but as a rule, if I'm around a bunch of cattle for an hour or two or such a matter, it ain't too big a job whenever we get them in the pens for me to say this is so and this is this and this is so and so. But there again is, like Stanlow said, you don't learn these things overnight, and if you not got the cow interest in your mind concerning it, I really don't believe that it would appeal to you nearly so well.
This this mammying up that they're talking about is the terminology used for calves that have been out in the woods or wherever during roundup. You always find a bunch of them that are not with their mamas, and it fell a lot to the Cowboys. You couldn't always let them give them a week at a time for them to find their own mama. So they had this job of mammying up the calves with their mothers, and it was quite an unusual talent that some of the old time Cowboys, and I'm not calling you old time, Mary Junior, but that had okay.
Over here at Old Town, the Cherises had all that country. There was Tom Cherise and Green Cherise, and they had two or three sons apiece, and they were old-time cowmen over there. They're these legendary cowmen we've been talking about, or supposed to be talking about. And back during the war, back during World War II, they closed the border in Mexico. And all these rodeo men up through the Northwest couldn't get no horned steers for their roping and bulldogging. And so they called me and asked me if I could get them some bulldogging steers. So I went up to Mr. Green Chairs and talking to him, I knew he had plenty of them if I could just buy them from him. And he said, yeah, he said, I'll sell them to you. And I said, well, I want to pay a forfeit down on them. I want to be sure that I get these cattle. And he said, no, he said, I'm not going to let you pay nothing down on them, but he said, I want you to just be here the 1st of May. And he said, we'll have them in the pen, and said, you can buy them. So the 1st of May come around, and Faye and I had worked a week of getting everything ready so I could go up there and spend a couple of days and get these steers. I got up there, and he had done sold them the week before. And I was kind of disappointed because I knew I could get plenty of good horned steers there. So I said, well, I said, I'm not doing any good here. I said, I've got to buy some steers. And so I asked him, I said, what did you get for those steers? And he said, oh, the cattle wasn't worth very much then. He said, I think I got 9 cents. He said, what are you paying for them? I said, well, I'm paying 11 and 12.
Probably wasn't going to give but 9 for them to start with. Eight.
I'll tell you a little secret about this mamming up these calves. When you're riding among these cows and calves, when you catch a calf along by its mother, there's a spot on this calf somewheres that you readily recognize, and you automatically look at the cow. And it don't make any difference how long it is after that you look at the cow and calf again. This calf spot comes to your mind as to what cow it belongs to.
Yeah, it's an amazing thing because I noticed even some folks around here lose their young'un. They don't even know if it's their young'un or not when they see her. I run into a couple of them here yesterday that they lost their young'uns, and then a couple of young'uns come by and lost their mamas, so I didn't know if that was the two that need to be mammied or the two that was lost. No, ma'am, I don't. The cows is the only thing I mess with because they don't talk back to you, and they will bite you and hook you, but they don't talk back to you. Thought about the price of cattle. We've kept records on everything that we've ever done for the past 20 years, and we keep records on just about everything we've ever sold. And they was talking about 9 cents, and I remember it's not been too long ago, about 10 years ago, when it was 21 cents. And then it's not been maybe 3 or 4 years ago, it's $1.10. So a fella asked me a while ago, he said, well, how do you know when it's a good price? And I said, I don't have no idea. He said, well, how do you sell? I said, well, you go according to what the market price is. I said, you can't sell over the market price. Not down here in South Florida. You might can elsewhere, but not here in South Florida because nobody will buy anything over market price because in our area and further south, they're going to have to add whatever they give you. They're going to have to add another 3 or 4 cents to truck them out of here. And that's always been a problem with us because we may think we got top dollar for the cattle, but they still have to add a couple more cents, 3 cents more ahead. When we sell, we have to take 3 cents less. But it takes that much to ship them out from here or from where I am to out west, out to the feedlots.
Another legendary cowman was Judge Zibe King. Judge King was was noted, was very an important figure during the cattle wars down in Southwest Florida. Bone Mazel worked for Judge King, and someone swore out a warrant for Bone for rustling cattle. Now, Bone wasn't adverse to doing that. As a matter of fact, he did it a lot of times for his bosses because they had to replenish the stock that had been rustled from them. So they took him up before Judge Zibe King, and Bone just laid it right out on the table. He says, Judge, he says, I've stole hundreds of cows for you and put your brand on them, and said, here, I stole one little old measly cow for myself, and you're trying me. So he turned him loose. And this is a matter of record that happened down in DeSoto County. They had lynchings, they had assassinations, they had vigilante movements. And as I mentioned yesterday, DeSoto County in the 1880s and 1890s was just as wild as Tombstone, Deadwood, or any place out in the West. And I think it was Joe Ackerman here yesterday who wrote that fabulous book over here on the Florida cowman. If the Hollywood film crews had been here in Florida, they'd have gotten the very same stories out of here, and Kissimmee and Arcadia and Fort Thompson and LaBelle and some of these places would be just as famous as Deadwood, South Dakota, or Tombstone, Arizona. Junior, you want to give them a Bone Mazel story?
Well, I really don't know one for definite sure, but anyway, back in the early days, my wife's grandparents lived across the lower end of the state of Florida from one part of the state to the other in a traveling wagon most of the time, and my wife's grandfather was a hunter and a trapper. So they were caught some few miles, maybe 25 or 30 miles north of Okeechobee on the prairie, crossing the state in a covered wagon, and they had to camp in a big hammock called Mazel Hammock for about a week or 10 days. That's what they had planned to do. So the second night they were there, they got up the next morning and his team of horses was gone. And so he had to set out and walk about 9 or 11 miles across the prairie to an old friend's house and worked him out a team of horses. But anyway, the old man let him ride one of the horses and lead the other one back to carry his family to his ranch. And always, I'm referring to Bone again, always, my wife's granddaddy always felt like this same old man, Bone Mazel, might have been the man that borrowed his team of horses and forgot to return them to him.
Bone is probably the most legendary cracker cowboy of all. He was born in 1863 and died in 1921. And I'm finishing up a book on Bone, like one chapter yet. But he died in the Fort Ogden Depot while a depot agent went across the street to eat dinner. And he came back and Bone was slumped over there dead. And I've got a copy of his death certificate out of the public records, state public records. And the cause of death is written in pencil, said moonshine, went to sleep and didn't wake up. Bone would drink anything. He never married. He never owned a house. He owned a bunch of cows, and that's about it. When he came into town, he would not go inside and sleep in a house or in a hotel, an Arcadia house or anything like that. He would sleep out in the yard and put a rock under his head and sleep that night. As I said, he would drink anything, and he did, and he drank a lot of it. And someone told him one time, drinking's going to kill you. Well, it did. He is 58 years old, but it killed him. The crowning story of Bone's life, you'll give me a few minutes, I'll tell you about it. A poem was written about it, and a few years ago I put some music to this, Ballad of Bone Mazel. Bone worked for the Parkers out on 90 Mile Prairie, southeast of Arcadia. And he worked with an old cowhand named John Underhill. Well, they were out there working one time, and old man Underhill died. And they couldn't bring him out, of course. I don't know how far from town they were, but they couldn't bring him back. So they buried old man John Underhill out there on the prairies. Sometime later on, a young Jewish boy from New Orleans, who had had everything handed to him on a silver platter, been everywhere, traveled all over the world, he came off down into Florida, wanted to get away from it all and find peace and contentment out on the cattle ranges. So he got a job, and bless Pat, he was in the same cow crew with Bone Mazel. Well, he was kind of a sickly young boy, and it wasn't but a few months till he died, and they couldn't bring him out. So they buried him beside old John Underhill, right beside old man John Underhill. Well, sometime later on, the young Jewish boy's parents in New Orleans found out where he had been, so they contacted some people there in Arcadia and wanted to know about their son, and they wrote back and told him, yeah, he was here and said he died out on the cattle ranges, and he's buried out on the prairies, 90-mile prairie. So they got in touch then with an undertaker and wanted to know how they could find out where he was buried. So they got in touch with Bone. Bone said, yeah, we buried him out on the prairie. So the family sent money back down to Arcadia and to Bone to dig up their son's remains and send them back to New Orleans. Well, he got John Daugherty Joe Daugherty and a couple more guys, and they went out there. And on the way out there, Bone got to thinking about old John Underhill. He'd never been out of DeSoto County and always said that he wanted to. Now, wait a minute, you're getting ahead of me now. he'd always wanted to take a train ride, and Bone got to thinking about it. And when they got over there to dig the young boy up, they asked him, said, Bone, which one of these is a young boy? And he pointed to old John Underhill. So they dug up old John Underhill and shipped him to New Orleans, and Bone said there wasn't anything wrong with it because the boy didn't want to go anywhere, and said old John never had taken a train ride, and so we gave him his train ride. And it was later said that John Underhill was interred under a $3,000 monument down in New Orleans with the young boy's name on it. An unusual thing to this was the fact that when Bone died in 1921, they buried him out in the Joshua Creek Cemetery, and his grave was unmarked for years, I think something like 20 years. And finally, a group of interested citizens passed around the hat and got enough money to put Bone a marker out there and put his name on it and put the marker down there. And what do you know happened? They had it on the wrong grave, and I guess Bone turned over and laughed about that, but that's the honest truth. John, Vic, did you ever hear Bone?
Oh, yeah.
What story you got about him?
Well, y'all have told about all the good ones.
Well, anyway, Bone, I've got one more, and then we got the cow ladies coming in here in a few minutes. So I got one more Bone story. As I said, he drank quite a bit. Well, he got drunk in town one day, and some of them, after he passed out, they thought they'd just cart him off out to the cemetery, the Joshua Creek Cemetery, and lay him down out there in the graveyard. Well, they did, and left one guy there standing behind a tree or a tombstone or something to wait and see what would happen when Bone came out of his stupor. Well, it was a few hours, but they got back into town, and the guy said that Bone jumped up and rubbed his eyes and held his head a few minutes and looked around, and he says, well, here it is, Resurrection Day, and I'm the first one up. Anybody have any questions they'd like to ask? And we'll have the ladies in here in a few minutes and talking about the woman's role and the Florida ranching. Any questions you might have? Well, thank you so much. And we'll see you a little bit later.